Support for The Slow Melt comes from Audible.com, home of a diverse selection of digital audiobooks for your phone, e-reader, or MP3 player. Get a free 30-day trial and any audiobook of your choice for free, including a book written by our host, Simran Sethi. Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love, highlights changes in food told through the experience of flavor and stories of chocolate, beer, bread, wine, and coffee, and includes tasting guides to help you better navigate craft chocolate. Give it a taste at audibletrial.com/chocolate. Welcome to the Slow Melt Makers Series. I'm Simran Sethi, and today I'm speaking with Mark Carniello, the co-founder and chocolate maker behind Kylo Chocolate, based in Perth, Australia. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Simran, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, I've just woken up. It's in the morning here, but I've had a coffee, so I think I'm good to talk.
Fantastic. You're caffeinated, so we can ask all the important questions now.
Absolutely.
Share, if you will, a memory of a moment when chocolate really captivated you.
Well, it's an interesting one, Simran. I actually lived in Switzerland for many years. My parents are Swiss, and I was always under the impression that I lived in the country that made the best chocolate in the world. It only actually happened a few years back when I was living in Southern California. We went up to Santa Barbara for a weekend away. And when you live in Southern California as an Australian, you're always on a quest to find good coffee. And we found this place called the French Press. And when I was in there at the counter, they had a little display of 24 Blackbirds craft chocolate. And I picked up this little bar, and on the back it said, handmade from bean to bar right here in Santa Barbara. And that was really the moment when I realized, oh, wow, like you can make chocolate locally, you know, in a small craft process. It doesn't all have to come from a giant factory somewhere in Europe. So that was really my aha moment, just realizing that not all chocolate is coming out of the industrial world. And that really started my journey of discovery on craft chocolate in general.
And was part of that discovery realizing there were different origins? That was a big thing for me, like the terroir, the taste of place in chocolate was something that I couldn't have even fathomed before I tasted a craft chocolate bar.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just took me a while to appreciate that, yeah, you can make craft chocolate, and wow, the 70% dark chocolate from 24 Blackbirds, you can't even compare it to what I'd been eating from the supermarket. And then, yeah, in the second round, realizing, oh, wow, there are all these different origins. And obviously, like with wine or with coffee, the origins taste different. There's a terroir there. There are varying levels of quality depending on how it's been processed. So, yeah, it's a lovely journey of discovery. And I'm still amazed today sometimes when I try a single origin bar at how different these bars taste depending on where they've come from, how they've been fermented, even down to the roasting. I've had a few bars from the same plantation in Madagascar, and just taking the same beans and seeing how differently the bar tastes depending on how the roasting's been done and the chocolate's been made is amazing as well.
How did you go from tasting that bar to actually creating Kylo?
Well, so after I tried the 24 Blackbirds, I was quite intrigued. So I emailed the address on the back, and he emailed me back. And one of the lovely things for me was I realized there's a whole community of people out there in this craft chocolate world who are very open, and there's a very sharing environment there. So you can read a lot about how this is made, what to do, what not to do, etc. So I did some research, and I thought, well, when I move back to Australia, I'd really like to see if I can just start making some chocolate at home for fun. And then I got back to Perth, which, for those who don't know, is on the west coast of Australia. It's thousands of kilometres from any other major city here in Australia. And I realised quickly that the key ingredient, of course, for good craft chocolate, good cocoa beans, and getting them in Perth was pretty much impossible. It was very expensive, very far away from any other suppliers. So I pretty much gave up on that idea, unfortunately. Fast forward a few years, I was playing beach volleyball with my mate, Jose, who's actually from Panama. And after the game, we sat down and he was telling me about his coffee roasting business. He actually imports coffee beans directly from Panama. And he said, oh, you know, in the next shipping container, we might just throw in a ton or two of cocoa beans. What do you think? Is that a good idea? And I said, wow, this is great. I've always been wanting to make chocolate, but I've never had access to beans. So yeah, we sort of had a chat and we said, well, let's do it. Let's, you know, let's make some chocolate from these beans that are coming over. So we'd literally never seen a cocoa bean in our lives when we decided to found Kylo Chocolate.
So the shipment comes in and you see the beans and you're like, what?
Yeah, it was very interesting. And obviously I'd seen pictures of beans online in the things I'd read about, but I'd never actually held a bean and, you know, tasted a raw bean. So it was a very interesting start. Usually people do things a bit differently, but we just had this opportunity of sourcing some great beans from Panama. So yeah, they arrived here and we were very happy with the first results of our trials.
Did you have access to some of the professional equipment, or did you really kind of put this together on your own?
It's amazing how you can live far away from any other major, you know, craft chocolate making community, and you can read up on everything. So yeah, we pretty much did all of our research online and had all the equipment shipped in from overseas into Perth and started like that.
What were some of the sites that drew you in, or who are some of the people that you talked to?
John Nancy, the chocolate alchemist, is probably, I think, one of the key reasons that many of us craft chocolate people are around today. His website and his forums there are invaluable. And there are many other people on that forum that I know have their own chocolate businesses and have had for many years. And they're very generous with their advice they give to people starting up. You have a problem, you post on that forum, and it's amazing how helpful people are there. So it's great to see. I love that collaborative spirit of this craft chocolate movement, where everyone's actually very keen to share and help out new people. In hindsight, I asked many stupid questions, but it's lovely to see that people didn't just put me down. They took the time to answer them and point out what we might have been doing wrong. So it's great.
So where are you today? When did you found the company and where are you now?
We've been going for just about 12 months, Simran, so we're still quite new and we're very happy with how things are going. We're struggling to keep up with demand, which is a good sign, I guess. And yeah, I think the difference between Australia and North America is you guys have really had an explosion of craft chocolate over the last few years. We've not really had that yet here in Australia. So your average consumer that walks into a store, many of them are not aware yet of the concept of craft chocolate or bean to bar. So there's still a lot of education required there on the consumer side. But the lovely thing is that people are very receptive to these ideas. And once they hear about the fact that, oh, wow, most of the chocolate I eat is industrial and the growers have, you know, not been treated well in many cases, they really connect with that. And everyone's very interested and very supportive. So it's actually nice to be in this phase of the industry here in Australia, where you're educating people about what craft chocolate is and why it's different to the industrial chocolate.
Do you feel any extra sense of responsibility as being part of this newer movement in Australia? Because people are going to form their idea of what craft chocolate is in part through what they taste from you.
Yes, that's a good point. If you communicate the wrong way, or if you act unethically, if you produce poor quality product, I think that could really damage the craft chocolate industry here in Australia. So it is important to always emphasize to people, why are we doing this? I think the key thing is, I know there are some medium or small size craft chocolate folks who I get the impression are just trying to become the next Cadbury or Hershey's. And that's really not what this is about, in our opinion. So yeah, I think it is an important thing to communicate the values properly to the consumers here, and also give them a product that really does stand out and is significantly better than what they're getting from the industrial producers.
So when you talk about sort of what your values are all about, what are they?
I think, first of all, for me, and I think a lot of the craft chocolate people have this value intrinsically somehow, it's honesty. You know, there are no hidden processes or ingredients in play here. People are always amazed when we say to them, this bar here has been made from just two ingredients, cocoa beans that Jose's brought in from Panama and, you know, raw sugar from Queensland. And I think that's, you know, people really appreciate that, that that's it. High quality is a key point for us as well. I see no reason why we would try to make a chocolate bar that can compete price-wise with the industrial guys. We'd have to compromise so much on quality. I wouldn't see the point in doing that. I think the fact that we're making it local is also really important. I love that in my very first discovery, I'm in Santa Barbara and I pick up a chocolate bar and it says on the back, made here in Santa Barbara. And people here in Perth are very proud of their food and wine. And it's great to actually be producing something here locally as well. Obviously, tying in with that honest keyword is the ethical sourcing. I really think it's great to know that the farmers that we get our cocoa beans from in Panama get fairly paid for what they do. And no nonsense also. You know, there's a lot of people out there in this craft world in general, not just chocolate, that have fancy packaging and a lot of great marketing, and it's gluten-free and it's got all these other special logos on the back. Really, we're just making good chocolate that we like to eat. So this is not going to make you healthier or look younger. This is just going to give you some enjoyment when you taste it. And I think that's also a key thing that we try to convey.
And, you know, I think that joy does make you feel better and look younger. Okay, I have two questions stemming off of that. First, you mentioned you don't have a lot of these logos or designations. Let's talk about that for a minute, because you mentioned ethical sourcing, but you don't have any certifications. So tell me a little bit about that decision.
Really, there are two things there. As you know very well, Simran, these farmers that are producing this great cocoa, mm-hmm. they don't have a lot of means to actually fund this certification process. So on one side, we've got the producers in country who don't always have the means to actually be officially certified. And then also on our side in Australia, the process to go through to get official Australian organic certification is quite capital intensive. So we honestly just don't have the means to do that right now. We trust our growers that the product they're producing is organic. I don't really care if there's a certification stuck on that or not. I'm happy that they say they're organic, and we know that it's just not certified.
This podcast is brought to you by Rotar Chocolate Machines, a chocolate grinder designed and built by a chocolate maker for chocolate makers and made in the United States. Get all of the details at www.rotar.com. This episode is also brought to you by Blue Apron, the meal delivery service that works directly with artisanal purveyors and family-run farms to bring meals to your door. Get $30 off your first order plus free shipping by going to blueapron.com/chocolate.
So the second question I want to ask you is something that you'd said about ingredients. You mentioned the sugar and, of course, the cocoa from Panama. And there's something else that you're including in your bars that is really quite special. Can you talk about those inclusions?
Yeah, sure. Once we'd made some chocolates in our first phase, we said to each other, well, okay, so we can make some nice 70% dark chocolates that are from Panama, single origin. We can make some dark milk and all those sorts of things. We could make white, but we're not going to go there right now. And we said, well, what's going to be special about us? Like, we're here in Australia. What do we want to sort of showcase? And we said, well, really, there's so many native foods here in Australia that have been undervalued for so long after European settlement. Let's see if we can actually start looking at including some of these native ingredients in our chocolates to showcase those. Some of them just go really well with chocolate. I love how lemon myrtle pairs with the dark chocolate, for example. But also just to raise awareness of all these great ingredients that are out there that can be used that have really been neglected in the last 200 years.
And they're extraordinary. So I am really excited that what we're going to be tasting together is the ouray bar. And that, well, why don't you tell us what ouray is while I start to unwrap this gorgeous chocolate?
No worries. Well, I mean, ouray, just the name's groovy, right? When you just see that name, you think that's really cool. I love that double O sound. It sounds great. The sad thing is that really there's a history of ure being used by Aboriginal people that goes back tens of thousands of years. You know, we're talking way before any, you know, European civilization even emerged. When the Europeans arrived, they pretty much ignored this local knowledge. And it's nice that we've now picked up on that. And the lovely thing about ure, in my opinion, is there's really an unbroken use of that term ure that goes back tens of thousands of years. Ure is a native rainforest plant from the rainforest on Australia's east coast. It has a very tart, acidic component to it. Apparently, if you try to bite into one, it's very difficult to eat. It's very sour. But it just gives when you pair it with chocolate, it just gives it a lovely lift, that dark chocolate. And it's also a superfood. I mean, ure has 100 times the content of vitamin C compared to oranges. It's got more antioxidants than blueberries. But again, we're only just rediscovering all these great properties that the Aboriginal people knew about. When the whites arrived, they just said, well, we don't care about this stuff. I think the name ure that we use is also a bit of a statement. People also call ure Davidson's plum. Just that typical colonialist, oh, okay, I found this thing. It looks a little bit like a plum. I'm going to call it after my fellow explorer, Mr. Davidson from the UK. But really, it has nothing to do with plums at all. So we're using ure as well as a bit of a statement, rejecting that whole Eurocentric worldview and embracing the original name that it has.
Okay, now I've opened it and I'm staring at it and my mouth is starting to water. Please tell me what, there's that sourness that you mentioned. What kind of flavors should we find also in the poco?
Look, it's very hard. People always ask when they see the ure bar, what's this going to taste like? And you can compare it to other things. Some people say that it tastes a little bit like a cherry or it's got some raspberry notes, but really it does have its own distinctive, unique flavor. And I try to say to people, look, you just have to try it. You can't compare it to anything else. But yeah, I guess if someone's never tried and is listening here, it does have that sort of that slight tang that you might get from a raspberry or dark cherry addition to a chocolate bar. The cocoa itself, we're trying to not overpower the Boca del Toro cocoa that you have in there. I find that actually has quite a lot of nutty, earthy type undertones, that particular bar, that match well with those fruity accents that the ure addition gives it.
I mean, since you said you have to try it to know it, I've gone ahead and done that as the stand-in for our listeners. And that's it. It's almost like they come together, but it's two very distinct sides. Like what I'm getting from that ure, that really lovely tart, almost a bite, is really tempered by this really nice rounded cocoa. So as I'm savoring this chocolate, I'd love to know, what else do you wish chocolate lovers better understood about chocolate and chocolate making?
Well, I think you have to define what you mean by chocolate lover there, Simran. If the chocolate lover is the person who really appreciates good quality craft chocolate, I think they probably know more about chocolate than I do in some cases. So it's more the general public, as I mentioned before, in Australia here, craft chocolate is still very young. So we just want them to appreciate where things are coming from. And it's great. We have these discussions with people at tastings when they realize, oh, wow, a lot of this industrial cocoa comes from West Africa, where people are really working in terribly poor conditions. And then I tell them that, you know, I see chocolates at the supermarket that are on special, and the prices that they're actually asking retail are way less than what we pay the farmers in Panama on the ground just for the raw ingredients. So it's interesting. So I think people are starting to appreciate that whole supply chain and the industrial process that's associated with it. And yeah, one thing, as you mentioned earlier on, Simran, is the variation between different origins. Once people start to see that difference, they're really amazed by how different the cocoa beans taste. And again, having an educated population here in Perth that's interested in great food and wine, they straight away say, oh, well, this is sort of like wine. You've got Cabernet from Margaret River, tastes different to Cabernet from Coonawarra, different to a Cabernet from Napa or Bordeaux. So once people sort of get that first information, they appreciate that, of course, cocoa beans are going to taste different depending on where they're coming from and depending on how you treat them in your making process. So I think it's a great process, a great journey that we're all on. And I think in 20 years' time, we'll look back on this with amazement on how this all started.
I think you're absolutely right. And I really appreciate you sort of reminding me that there's not a singular chocolate lover. We go through these progressive levels of awareness or understanding or appreciation, moving from I like wine to I like red to I like a Merlot, and then choosing a particular region as an area that really resonates. And I think that's really interesting, because I remember with coffee, you know, I thought, okay, well, I know I prefer a cappuccino to a flat white, but I had no idea, you know, that espresso from Ethiopia or a coffee made with Ethiopian beans would be very different from one, you know, made with Panamanian beans or Costa Rican beans or beans from Indonesia or what have you. So it is really exciting to see that evolution in chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
So last question, what have you learned and what would you impart to makers who are just now getting started?
I think there's an unbelievably generous community online out there to help people get started. So really, you know, embrace that and get involved in that community. You can literally sit in your lounge room wherever you are in the world, and you can read all about making craft chocolate, and you can order cocoa beans that you've never seen before, like we did, and you can start making craft chocolate. Of course, once you've got the base knowledge from reading, you need the experience. You need to actually start tempering, for example. Yeah, tempering sounds easy when you read about it, but when you start doing it yourself, there is practice involved. But and taste, of course. And it's lovely how online people say, look, you know, here's the general steps you need to take, but now you need to actually taste it, and you need to compare these different batches you've made, and you need to decide based on your taste what you're going to prefer, what your clients are going to prefer. So, but we were amazed, like literally the first or second batch we made, no surprise in hindsight, we did have some industrial chocolates in our house. And when we compared those blind, it was just, we were blown away at how much better our very first batch was than what the industrial guys produced. But in hindsight, it's not really fair to compare what we make with what those guys make. I know, Simran, a while back you had a lady from Mars on the show, and it was great to hear how, you know, really Mars has also been to Bar, and they are very good at making a very consistently tasting M&M. And I think that's also to be commended. It's not fair to compare that. Again, coming back to the wine analogy, you know, we can't compare a top growth Bordeaux or a Grange to a $5 Italian wine that's just been made for quaffing at lunchtime. They're different products with different target audiences, and they're both well made. They're just made with very different aims.
And that's been really critical for me in this podcast, to not share one to the exclusion of the other, because I think, like you said, that's where you started. That's certainly where I started. And I certainly do still appreciate a Twix or an M&M when I'm in the airport, and my tastes have evolved, but that doesn't mean that I still don't have a deep appreciation for that larger industry. And I think it's interesting to see for me how that bigger industry is moving toward now recognizing origin, for example, and really trying to highlight single origin, or looking even at business practices. And so I think there's really a lot to be learned from both industries.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So tell me this, who were your greatest teachers? And I mean that not actually in John Nancy and the website, but rather in tasting bars. Are there any craft chocolate makers that you're really enjoying now, or that you'd highlight as being some of your greatest teachers as you were trying to create your own chocolate bars?
There are so many lovely bars out there. It's very difficult to name one favorite or even a few. Again, coming back to the wine analogy, I mean, I love Margaret River Bordeaux style wines. I also love German Rieslings or Sweet Tokays from Hungary. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard. I digress slightly there, sorry. But coming back to your question, recently one bar I've really enjoyed was the Maru Treasure Island. And I think part of the reason for that was I heard your interview with the Maru guys about Treasure Island, the story behind it, the grower. They've had the drought there, and how this cacao on that island is very special. So it's lovely when you know the story behind the chocolate bar. It just, like with wine or with coffee or with any other great food, it just really makes the enjoyment so much more interesting when you know the story behind it.
And I love what you're saying. This is actually in episode 2 of the Maker Series, Sean Eskenazi talks about this, how it is more delicious because of the story. So thank you for sharing your story.
No worries. You're welcome.
Podcast listeners, you can learn more about Kylo Chocolate on their website, kylochocolate.com. And use the code SLOWMELT to get a discount on the purchase of the Ouray bar we just tasted. You can also order the Maker Series Tasting Pack, featuring every one of the bars in this series, exclusively through chocolopolis.com. Check our website, theslowmelt.com, for all details, discount information, and dates of the promotion. To hear shows on growing cocoa as a way to support a bird sanctuary in the Dominican Republic, and on the evolving definitions of craft chocolate, find the Slow Melt episodes on our website, or look for us on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Slow Melt. The Slow Melt Maker Series is mixed and produced by Katie Ranke, with guidance from Sean Corey Campbell, and is written and edited by me, Simran Sethi, with support from Sasha Woodruff. Our title track, Soldier, is written and performed by The Slackers. Join us week after next for a Maker Series episode featuring Theo Chocolate and another fantastic tasting session. And if you like what you're hearing, please consider telling your friends, giving us a review or a donation, or subscribing through your favorite podcast app. Choco love and thanks for all your support.